Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 265, quarter of the week of June 19th, 2024. Swing and a whiff. Good evening, Matt. How's it going?
Good. How are you today?
Well, doing good. Happy June 19th to you. Juneteenth, as they call it now. Which I keep forgetting is a holiday until it stumbles across me. And then I remember it's a holiday and I'm glad we have it and honoring all the people around Juneteenth. But it was a bit of a whiff this week on co-hosts. Just me and you.
Yeah. Too many people taking PTO, I guess.
They're taking advantage of that that Juneteenth day off they might have from their employer, apparently, and coupling it with a day off at the beach or in the woods with their children, which doesn't sound like a vacation, but yeah. We'll see.
I had a coworker come back from a week off last week, and he was like, I am exhausted and ready to get back to work. A week off with two kids is definitely not a great vacation.
Yes, indeed. Well, I'm about to leave for FinOpsX. I fly out tomorrow during June 19th. So I'll be heading down to San Diego to join all my FinOps practitioner friends to see all the cool stuff that all the vendors are going to have, the keynotes. I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, just going to San Diego is nice in addition to that. So I'm happen to be flying on my travel day. There is a reception at 5 o'clock. Apparently the FinOpsX Foundation did not get the memo about Juneteenth either. But looks like it'll be a good overall session. So looking forward to it. I'll recap it next week here on the show. But let's get into some new news for the week. First up, HashiCorp had a couple of new releases this week. The first one we'll talk about is Consul 1.19 is now generally available, improving your user experience, providing flexibility, and enhancing integration points. Consul 1.19 introduces a new registration custom resource definition that simplifies the process of registering external services into the Consul mesh. Consul service mesh already supports routing to services outside the mesh through terminating gateways. However, there are advantages to using the new registration CRD, including that it automatically sets up your terminating gateway and all the routing rules for it. Consul snapshots can now be stored in multiple destinations. Previously, you could only snapshot to a local path or to a remote object store destination, but not both. Now you can snapshot to NFS mounts, SAN attached storage, or object store on any of the hyperscalers. And Consul API Gateway can now be deployed on Nomad, combined with transparent proxy and enterprise features like admin partitions. I don't know what the UI used to look like. They did say it was a new UI. I saw a screenshot of it. I said, looks cool. No idea what it used to look like.
Yeah, I mean, this did release a whole bunch of, you know, nice new features. Some of the snapshotting, I think, is useful, you know, especially with going to your object store of choice versus, you know, only being able to do local or remote storage. So it gives you a little bit more options. What I was surprised about, which I did not know, was that Consul API Gateway can now be deployed on Nomad. Was it not able to be deployed before?
Apparently not.
Just feels weird.
That seemed a little weird.
Yeah, you know, Consul should be able to be deployed on Nomad compared to that. You know, it's all the same company, but sometimes Team A doesn't always talk to Team B.
Well, speaking of Team B, Vault 1.17 is now generally available with new secure workflows, better performance, and improved secrets management scalability. The most important feature is Workload Identity Federation, or the WIF of our show title, allowing you to eliminate concerns around providing security credentials to Vault plugins. Using the new support for WIF, a trust relationship can be established between and an external system and Vault's identity token provider to access the external system. This enables secretless configuration for plugins that integrate with external systems such as AWS, Azure, and GCP. Two new features around PKI certificates for your IoT or a Stravis established certificate on boot up whatever EST that now supports those use cases, as well as a custom certificate metadata. And one feature that I had never really thought about, but I'm glad to see it now, is the Vault Enterprise has got seal high availability. Previously, you relied on a single key manager system to securely store the Vault seal key. This could create a challenge if your KMS provider had an issue such as being deleted, disaster recovered, or compromised by a hacker. And in such a case, the Vault couldn't be unsealed. Now with the new HA feature, you can configure independent seals secured with multiple KMS providers for that DR need. There's also extended namespace and mount limits, as well as the Vault secret operator now supports instant updates for those zero-day password issues, or if your password gets found on the dark web, the Vault secret operator can instantly update to prevent that from being a problem. So nice updates to Vault as well.
Yeah, I think overall there's a lot of nice features in it. The enterprise seal high availability is something I never thought about and now terrifies me when I look back at a few of the implementations of Vault that I've done in the past. Just one of those things I never fully thought about, though.
Yeah. As I was reading through it, I was like, oh, yeah, if someone gets access to your account and can delete your KMS keys, then they could seal your vault, and then you're totally hosed. Yeah. It was definitely something I had not really considered at all. Even the console feature where they talked about the ability to do the backup to multiple systems, I guess you could have always done remote object store, then set up a custom, you know, S3 event to basically then replicate that to another bucket. But I'm surprised that took so long for that to come into place too, because having multiple paths is a good 3-2-1 backup strategy in general, and just good practice. So that was a surprise too. So a couple definitely like hadn't thought about that problem features here.
Yeah, and obviously the Work Identity Federation is pretty nice. You know, the integrations and because always, you know, shoving your own toil into between to make these things work, little Lambda Spackle or whatever you need to do to kind of keep these pieces in synchronization, it was always kind of a pain. And I feel like we talked about this when it was in beta a few weeks ago, or it was announced at HashConf that this was coming out, but it's nice to see it be GA'd and hopefully it streamlines some of the pain of keeping everything synchronized.
Yeah. I'm still waiting for the sync feature. That's when I'm... Yeah. That was not announced this one, but I don't know which version of Vault that's going to be rolled into, but the ability to sync the secrets to, you know, your hyperscaler's secrets store is going to be just a really great feature I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, I mean, just the, you know, thinking like if you're using ECS or AKS, you know, they'll natively read from all the local stores, so versus having to kind of figure out how to get it
more
in
toil.
There or have it read, more toil, you know, natively just say, oh, here's the ARN or here's the Key Vault ID and the in the name of it and you're done, you know, it's just so much simpler. You know, the cloud providers have already kind of figured out that workflow. So versus building your own, you know, having these built into something, especially such as prevalent as Vault, feels odd that it wasn't there before still, but you know, you can't get everything day one.
Well, in honor of FinOpsX starting tomorrow, of course, the press releases have started. And there was one ridiculous one that we're not going to talk about, which was some vendor basically patenting the ability to update tags from inside their FinOps tool. I was like, that's not patentable. Like, I appreciate that you're trying, but not really that.
Good luck.
Good luck, you know, trying to defend that one in court. But VMware Tanzu Cloud, Cloud Health, is upgrading its entire user experience and apparently will be showing it off at X at its booth. It's available today as a tech preview for interested customers to reach out to their account team to request more information. The FinOps and cloud operations teams will find collaborating easier with the new UI, with all users accessing the same data and using a shared platform. Now, I've used Cloud Health. I don't remember there being a different set of data sets, but apparently that was an issue in more recent versions. And the Tanzu Cloud Health UI is powered under the hood by a unique graph data store. The significance of the graph data store lies in the ability to capture many-to-many relationships, typically in multi-cloud environments. And the new UI includes a vastly enhanced feature set, including Tanzu Intelligent Assistant, which is an LLM-enabled chatbot that allows users to gain insights with their clouds and services, including resources, metadata, configuration, status, through natural language without following a specific query format. The Cloud Smart Summary, a concise summary of the vast data in your cloud bills, including what drives your cloud spending, why they change over time, and instructions for how you can optimize your costs further. The Optimization Dashboard, a single customizable pane that combines all available committed discount recommendations, right-sizing opportunities, and anomalous spending across your cloud and services, and Realized Savings, which detailed reporting analysis alongside key performance indicators that quantify savings realized over a desired timeframe. Now, I'm mostly impressed with this press release because they said all of that without actually using the words AI or artificial intelligence anywhere. Yes, they did have 10 intelligent assists, and it is LLM-enabled, but someone in marketing should be fired for not specifically having the AI keyword that any investor or Broadcom would, of course, want to see in this press release.
Yeah, it's amazing they were able to get through without that. Or I think this was a bet from somebody. Can you write a press release without AI and see if it will get approved to the public? See what happens.
And apparently it can.
Yeah.
But I was, you know, I heard a scan of it. I was like, as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh, there's going to be AI on this for sure. And I scanned through it and I missed the Tanzu Intelligent Assistant until I was writing up the show notes. And I was like, oh, no, there is AI in here. It's LLM-enabled chatbot. But, you know, again, at some point, LLM-enabled chatbot's not considered AI either. But we'll go back to ML being the true AI. But, you know, having used some of these query languages, I'll just say that's probably my favorite feature of all LLMs right now is in Athena, being able to use AI through Q to write queries or to be able to write you know, Jira queries now and Confluence and Jira, where you can actually say like, hey, I want to see all the tickets from this person from these dates to this date. And it just writes JQL and I don't have to think about it anymore because I will say that I've hacked my way through JQL many a time, but I am not a pro at it by any stretch.
Oh, I think I have like a 12 line long JQL query that like merges stuff together that I've stolen from and expanded on. It just keeps growing and growing. And I'm like, okay, somebody needs to optimize this query because somebody at Atlassian is eventually going to ping me and be like, how come when you run this query, our entire system goes down?
Well, I don't think they're multi-tenant on the database, so I don't know they'll ever notice. You'll just take yourself down.
Yeah, details. Details.
All right, well, moving on to AI is how ML makes money for this week. First up, Databricks Lakeflow, a unified intelligence solution for data engineers. Data Lakeflow is a new solution that contains everything you need to build and operate production data pipelines. It includes new native, highly scalable connectors for databases, including MySQL, Postgres, SQL Server, and Oracle, and enterprise apps like Salesforce, Dynamics 365, NetSuite, Workday, ServiceNow, and Google Analytics. Users can transform data in batch and streaming using standard SQL and Python commands, and they are also announcing the real-time mode for Apache Spark, allowing stream processing at orders of magnitude faster latencies than microbatch. Finally, you can orchestrate and monitor workflows and deploy to production using your CI/CD pipeline.
So about 5 years ago, you walked around any of these tech conferences and all you saw was cloud health, cloud spend, cloud whatever, something cloud. And I feel like the new thing is lake whatever, lake flow. I'm like, how am I ever going to find this in the future when I'm like, oh, I want to look this up. Oh, it's that one with lake in its name.
Yeah. Well, it's a, I was thinking about it earlier and I was like, well, you know, for a half second there, I thought we were going a different direction because they introduced the idea of data mart. Mm-hmm. You remember? But the,
yeah.
You know, and I assume they went to data mart because they ran out of lakes or water bodies to use, you know, data ocean, data puddle, data stream, data, you know, data lake. And, you know, it's funny to me that they chose lake flow because one of the things that lakes don't really do is flow typically by definition, unless they're like, you know, a river that we dam to become a lake to, you know, power hydroelectric and things like that. But lakes are typically static.
Yeah. So this is for all your static data that you put in and you can never get out without getting charged a lot of money.
No, no, you're not supposed to think about this hard. This is the flaw. Oh, you're sorry. Thinking about the, and it's not a lake like that. It's just, yeah, anyways. Yeah, it's a little weird. But I hope at some point we'll run out of water things to compare to.
Yeah. I mean, it is kind of nice. You know, they are doing the streaming, so you can kind of actually orchestrate this a little nicely. So it does seem like it has some nice features besides just a fun-filled name for us to make fun of all the time. But, you know, it does have some nice features. And I don't use Databricks right now. So, you know, you don't have a lot to say about it. But it feels like it's kind of hitting, you know, with the connectors into pretty much almost every SQL database out there and all the big enterprise apps. You know, it should be a good, easy way to get everything into one place and process into what you need. So they've kind of hit a lot of the big names on the initial release.
Well, they also announced that they're open sourcing the Unity Catalog, the industry's first open source catalog for data and AI governance across clouds, data formats, and data platforms. There are five really important pillars to the Unity Catalog vision. One, it's an open source API implementation of data connectors, multi-format support, multi-engine support, multimodal, and a vibrant ecosystem of partners. And, you know, looking through this, it sort of reminds me a little bit about like when Tesla just, you know, released all the patents of all of their electrical infrastructure as a way of like, you know, making it sound good and they're open part of the community. And all I really see here is that this is just their implementation of Iceberg and REST APIs and basically plug-in connectors that are probably already available on all your other cloud providers. But this is the open source version, so you're supposed to feel better about it. And I appreciate the effort, but, you know, it's not really scratching the itch for me. There are a couple quotes here in the article. AWS welcomes Databricks to move to an open source Unity catalog. AWS is committed to working with industry and open source solutions that enable choice and interoperability for customers. Yeah, sure do, Amazon. And Google had to say, Google is committed to open, flexible solutions that empower customers to maximize the value of their data. Databricks' strategy to open up the Unity catalog standard for data and AI aligns very well with our strategy. So apparently they're getting some love there from the cloud providers. They do have some plans to continue rolling out new features to this, including support for the APIs that are critical to your data, including format agnostic table write APIs, views, delta sharing models with MLflow, remote functions, access control APIs, and much, much more. But you can get started with this today. If you're a Databricks customer, you already have access. And if you're not, good luck figuring out how to integrate it.
I mean, I do like you said, it makes me feel good. We're releasing open standards that, you know, hopefully one day more and more companies will embrace, you know, but are other companies actually going to embrace it? This is one of those, remind me in a year and let's see where this is actually at, to see if this is actually useful or not.
Yeah, I'd love to see some implementations of the Unity catalog that are not Databricks specific. And if that happens, yeah, then sure, I'm all for it.
I mean, I know that Amazon and SageMaker has had multimodal endpoints for a couple of years now. I'm trying to put in the timeline in my head of when I found, when they were working on to when it was released with a customer. Still don't really know what that is. And I still need to at one point figure that out. But, you know, I feel like there already are standards, whether they're an open source standard or not. It's another story with some of these.
Don't know. All right, let's move on to AWS. It's a little bit of a slow news week for AWS. Kind of shocking about this. But first up, they decided to poke the eye in China, China's eye, by announcing that Taiwan will have a new region in early 2025. Of course, assuming nothing bad geopolitically happens, the new AWS Asia-Pacific Taipei region will consist of three availability zones at launch. There was a quote from Marcus Yao, Senior Executive Vice President of Carthay Financial Holdings, basically saying Carthay Financial Holdings will continue to accelerate digital transformation in the industry and also improve the stability, security, timeliness, and capability of our financial services. The forthcoming new AWS region in Taiwan, CFH, is expected to provide customers even more diverse and convenient financial services in country.
More regions are always better.
More regions are always better. That one, bold choice, location-wise.
I'm sure there's a lot more behind the scenes that's happening that they had reasons to do it there, or, you know, they were getting pressured to do it. So I feel like Amazon's such a big behemoth that they probably are one of the few companies that can actually pull this off. You know, the other hyperscalers probably can too, but, you know, my company opening a business there probably wouldn't go quite as well. So it'll be interesting to see how it all goes.
And then in one of these confusing multiple options to do the same thing, Amazon is announcing support for Maven, Python, and NuGet package formats directly in Amazon Code Catalyst package repositories. Code Catalyst customers can now securely store, publish, and share Maven, Python, and NuGet packages using popular package managers such as MVN, Pip, NuGet, and more. Through Code Catalyst package repositories, you can now also access open source packages from six additional public package registries. And then I just like, why do you have Code Artifact if this is what you have instead? Like, very confusing.
Wait, this isn't their code. Oh, I mixed that up in my head. I thought this was Code Artifact.
Nope, this is Code Catalyst.
Oh, now I have to figure out what the difference between the two are.
Ah, well, I had to answer this question earlier because I too was confused.
Okay, so I don't feel too bad.
Code Artifact is a build and release automation service that provides a centralized artifact repository, access management, and CI/CD integration. Code Artifact can automatically fetch software packages from public package repositories on demand, allowing teams to access the latest versions of application dependencies. While Code Catalyst is a unified service that helps development teams build, deliver, and scale applications on AWS, it provides a managed experience that can reduce friction in the software development lifecycle, allowing teams to focus on building software instead of custom tool chains. Code Catalyst integrates with GitHub and GitHub Actions and dev environments. So it's like more of a elastic beanstalk for code development, but Code Catalyst versus Code Artifact, which is just one building block. And I would guess that Code Catalyst probably uses Code Artifact under the hood. You just don't see it.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of rereading as you were stating. I was like, okay, wait, one kind of contains the other. So,
yeah, I think that's how. I mean, knowing it's Amazon, though, they're probably completely isolated products. And so, yeah, they don't
actually leverage everything.
They don't leverage the same thing. So, you know, it's not very green.
It's all on S3, let's be honest. So, you know, everyone uses S3 in Amazon.
Moving on to GCP. Several new features for Cloud SQL for MySQL this week. First up is support for vector search to build generative AI applications and integrate with MySQL. Embedding data vectors allows AI systems to interact with it more meaningfully. Leveraging LangChain, the Cloud SQL team built a vector LangChain package to help with processing data to generate vector embeddings and connect it with MySQL. vector search embedded into MySQL. You can create embedded tables leveraging an AI to allow you to determine things about your data and your table, like the distance between two addresses, which this is the first time I've actually seen a video of someone using vector. And I was sort of intrigued and horrified at the same time. Because I'm like, I conceptually understand what you're doing. Like, you're creating this embedding table. You're using this data source to then add data that's relevant from a vector perspective, or this particular case was adding distance between these two addresses. But I'm like, how do you keep that up to date? Like, that was my big question. Like, you know, I get the first time, and, you know, I guess as you build your app, you have to basically keep updating the vector embeddings. Like, that's some overhead you're going to be adding to your database over time.
Yeah, I feel like keeping this inside of your database isn't probably the best place, like inside your main MySQL database, you know, just because I feel like you're throwing too many things in one place.
Well, I think they're saying the data is already living in this database that you want to add this bit of embedded data for from AI. And so there's this, you know, benefit of not having to store in a different place and work with different microservices. And so I assume that's why they think it's a good idea. I have a little bit of confusion around use cases. I get this one. I get the use case. I understand what they're trying to do. And yet they're showing, you know, routing between two restaurants, from where your location is to this restaurant. But, it does seem like a lot to put into your SQL database.
Yeah. I mean, I always worry when you put a large, more and more things embedded in the SQL databases, you kind of slowly build more and more of a single point of failure within your application, you know, because then your SQL database becomes compute and resource constrained more and more. And with SQL, scaling horizontally is a lot harder than, you know, scaling vertically. So you just normally end up scaling vertically and then you become less and less cloud native. So
I mean, I'd say opinions. In MySQL, I'm doing more horizontal than I would with Microsoft SQL. but it's still harder to do in MySQL. I mean, the advantage you want is like using AlloyDB or using Aurora, where you can decouple the compute from the storage, and then things get easier. But and maybe that's kind of the use case you think about too. But if your queries do slow down, the nice thing is they've now added Gemini to optimize, manage, and debug your MySQL database. Leveraging Index Advisor will identify queries that contribute to database inefficiency and recommends new indexes to improve them within the Query Insights dashboard, and then debug and prevent performance issues with active queries and monitor and improve the database health with the MySQL recommender.
These are always nice, but definitely you should pay attention to what they're doing before you blindly follow these. We've looked at a few of them. Microsoft has it embedded in at the day job. Like, they have Microsoft will automatically analyze your queries and kind of do the same thing. And we definitely found a few things that were like, that actually will do nothing. So keep an eye a little bit on them before you just blindly follow.
Again, I think that's the rule of thumb for pretty much all AI is, you know, it's a good place to start, but don't just put it into production without reviewing what it's actually doing or what it's trying to do, because it's not always perfect.
I feel like you should probably remind developers that on a daily basis.
Could be. Google is hosting a one-day virtual gathering on June 26th for AI and cybersecurity. The gathering will begin with a keynote session by Brian Roddy, VP of Google Cloud Security Engineering. Roddy will discuss the latest product updates from Google Security Operations, Google Threat Intelligence, Security Command Center, and Google Workspace Security, and share their vision for how AI and security can interact. After the keynote, there'll be several sessions, including Securing the Future, the intersection of AI and cybersecurity, Work Smarter, Not Harder with Gemini and Security Ops, Actionable Threat Intelligence at Google Scale, Breakthroughs in Building a Risk-Centric Strategy of Cloud Security, and Secure Enterprise Browser, Your Endpoint's Best Defense. And so I signed up for this because there's several of these sessions that I'm interested in. And so either I will miss it and then they'll send me video links on YouTube, or I will try to attend on the 26th.
I'm doing the same thing as we speak, is signing up and looking forward to listening to some of these things, just because I think that this is going to be a very interesting talk. I definitely like the work harder, not smarter, whether it's just a fun-filled title or, you know, whatnot. I think it should be interesting to kind of hear how they are embedding Gemini into just their SOC operations.
Yeah. I mean, I think SOC operations is a great place for AI to be able to add a lot of value for people. I'm also really curious about the secure enterprise browser. There's been a lot of chatter about different vendors who are creating secure enterprise browsers all of a sudden. And so I'd like to learn more about that too. I'm just intellectual curiosity at this point.
It's kind of like securing your computer. Just unplug it and you'll be better off.
Sure. Yeah, don't use the internet. All your problems are solved. And then Google's last announcement for this week, the cloud storage with hierarchical namespaces is now available. Data-intensive and file-oriented applications are some of the fastest-growing workloads on Google Cloud Storage. However, these workloads often expect certain folder semantics that are not optimized in a flat structure or of existing buckets. To solve this, Google announced hierarchical namespaces for cloud storage, a new bucket creation option that optimizes folder structure, resources, and operations. Now in preview, HNS can provide better performance, consistency, and manageability of cloud storage buckets. I think we talked about this before, but it was not available yet in preview. Existing cloud storage buckets consist of a flat namespace where objects are stored in one logical layer. Folders are simulated in the UI and CLI through slash prefixes, but are not backed by cloud storage resources and cannot be explicitly accessed via the API. This can lead to performance and consistency issues with applications that expect file-oriented semantics such as Hadoop Spark analytics and AI/ML workloads. It's not a big deal until you say you need to move a folder by renaming the path. And in a traditional file system, the operation is fast and atomic, meaning that the rename succeeds and all folder contents have their paths renamed. Or the operation fails and nothing changes. In a cloud storage bucket, though, when you do this rename operation, each object underneath the simulated folder needs to be individually copied and deleted. And if your folder contains hundreds of thousands of objects, this is slow and inefficient and also non-atomic. If the process fails midway, your bucket is left in an incomplete state. A bucket with a new hierarchical namespace has storage folder resources backed by an API, and the new rename folder operation recursively renames a folder and its contents as a metadata-only operation. This has many benefits, including improved performance, file-oriented enhancements, and platform support.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great feature, just kind of getting rid of all the day-to-day stuff. More one of those things that it just feels like they're really just announcing a rename feature, but then they've kind of set it up so you can only use this API call if you set it up in a very specific way. So I'm kind of more concerned that it's like, okay, they've optimized it. They've like over-optimized it in one way, and then can it cause performance issues on the other they don't talk about? So be kind of curious to see like how this actually works and if there's other issues. So, they've traded one pro and one con and swapped them, and now the pro that from blob storage before it becomes a con or, whatever it is. So be curious to see how this actually is in production.
Yeah, I'm curious too. I mean, again, it's just metadata manipulation. It's sort of the same thing that they used to do, just now they're using a different layer to calculate the folder pathing. But apparently that's faster than what it was doing before. So I am curious to see how it works in the real world, but I like the idea.
Yeah, I'm curious if like S3 has the same issues, because I know I've definitely renamed stuff and never had that type of a problem. So I'm wondering if they've solved it in a different way.
It was definitely one of those things I was curious about. In S3, even, it's a flat object structure. So I would assume right. They have similar challenges. Just maybe they've always used a metadata layer to store pathing data. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of makes more sense. I feel like S3 has gone now to like optimizing storage / cost / speed at like sub milliseconds, like with like one zone and stuff like that, where I feel like this is like just daily operations. Google's still working on. Yeah. But Microsoft still works on a lot of those too, so it's all good.
Well, Azure had one announcement, and I can't say a lot about it, so let's get through it. Microsoft is announcing Generative Chemistry and Accelerated DFT, which will expand how researchers can harness the full power of the platform. Generative AI will, together with quantum classical hybrid computing, augment every stage of the scientific method. And that's all I got out of this. I don't know what else it does. I don't know how it works. And we need Jonathan here, but he's not here today, so... Do your own research on this one.
I had nothing else for you. I tried to kill it because I didn't understand the story. So, but we felt bad for Azure.
No, we had no stories for Azure. And yeah, we would
have been bad. Yeah.
Yeah. I know it has something to do with quantum, and I know it has something to do with science and apparently generative chemistry. And that's as far as I got before I just was like, I don't understand what you're trying to do.
I feel like I need like an hour to like read the article, read all the links in it, because as it is a Microsoft article, there's links to 50,000 other articles in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. So you feel like you need to like actually process it, because it sounds pretty cool what they've done. And they have really good graphics in it. I just don't understand it.
Yeah. And there's a quote here from Alberto Prado, Global Head of R&D and Digital Partnerships at Unilever. Digital tools are unlocking an unprecedented age of scientific discovery. Using advanced computing power and AI, we are able to compress decades of lab work into days, accessing a new level of insight we could not previously have imagined. This technological leap, coupled with our vast repository of proprietary data, A center of expertise in personal and household care means our scientists are able to lead the industry in developing the next generation of consumer goods. Yes, yeah, I still have no idea how that worked out. So anyways, let's move on to the next story, shall we?
I don't think he said anything, but yes, let's move on.
I don't know that he said anything either, but it's going to help them develop new products. So good for Unilever. I guess my next bottle of shampoo for my non-existent hair will be quantum entangled. I have no idea.
It'll be AI powered shampoo. Yeah,
exactly. Oracle has a couple of things for us this week. First up, their fourth quarter and full year financial expectations were done. We don't do the horns. I see Matt
I'm
cringing.
Just being careful. I don't trust you.
You shouldn't trust me. But we don't do the horns for Oracle. They're not worthy because they wait so long to announce their earnings. But their fourth quarter results fell short of Wall Street expectations, with earnings per share of $1.63 adjusted and $14.29 billion in revenue. Cloud services and license ports were up 9% to $10.23 billion, and cloud infrastructure came up to $2 billion, up 42%, but slower growth than the prior quarter, where they had 49% growth, etc. Wall Street was not happy about this, but they overshadowed it by announcing their partnership with Google, which has driven their stock to new highs after the announcement, even though they missed earnings by a few $100 million.
I mean, when you're talking billions, what's a few hundred million?
Yeah, exactly. It's a rounding error.
Yeah,
it's fine. And the next one from Oracle, they have they're committed to helping organizations with continuous improvement and innovation. And so they're releasing the following new features to help you. Next gen access dashboard with details on who has access to what and when, support for expanded identity orchestration with Oracle's PeopleSoft HRMS, and configurable Oracle Cloud Infrastructure email delivery service for customized notifications. And when you look at this, it looks very similar to an IAM dashboard, but as you click into it, you get all kinds of visibility into what groups and roles you have, as well as nice pretty charts about policy statements and details, and overall just a lot of nice pretty graphs, which I appreciate.
Does the executive in you like those graphs?
I do, yeah. I don't know what they mean, but I like them.
Don't worry, no one knows what they mean either. The lawyer that's charging you extra for them knows what they mean.
It's sort of weird. The Oracle Access Governance utilizes this internal email delivery service for notifications. Like, well, what else would it have leveraged? I would hope you're using internal email delivery services to deliver email to me.
I thought that was interesting. Of like, here we built a new dashboard and all these things. Oh, and by the way, there's emails.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool. Thanks.
I do like the idea though that they're integrating with their HRMS, because one of the things that you sometimes start lacking. And a lot of these things is that you lose the context of the people and like what their org structure is. And so by coupling it with the HRMS capability, you can start doing more interesting dynamic access things like, oh, if this person's part of this group, then he needs this permission. And if he gets moved in the organization, this automatically gets updated based on the metadata from PeopleSoft. So it's authoritative. It's a managed system. So it's just overall a nice way to integrate your things together and pay Oracle more money if you don't have it.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking about that a lot, you know, based on like, you know, my day job and a few other things we've talked about, like how do we give permissions and when people move and how do we remove them? And, you know, from a full onboarding to offboarding perspective, how you handle it. And I've thought about it at some level in the cloud of like getting added to groups and have the group-based authentication. But a lot of that's still a little bit manual between Azure and our, you know, HRMS tool. So like having that full integrated and having that, you know, pretty much automatically update the permissions they get. So if you move from team A to team B, you know, how many times have you moved, you know, have you been in an organization when you moved and still retain those old permissions? So, which then comes up on an audit, and then somebody has to remove them and ask if you're still using them. And you have that whole song and dance you have to do. So it's kind of actually a really interesting idea of if it can fully integrate and your HRMS system can really become your identity management for your cloud provider straight without using an interim IDP or anything else like that. That's an interesting use case to set everything up properly.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing this from other people like integrating with Workday and with SuccessFactors and other HRIS systems. I think it could be really an interesting approach because, you know, typically those systems are authoritative. And today that authoritativeness typically goes to like an AD sync, and that typically replicates to Microsoft AD. And then from there, you got to figure it out. But again, like that's not always enough context of what's in the AD, because you don't always put all the reporting structure. You don't put in, you know, multiple levels of hierarchy that you might need to know that, hey, if you know, Justin's leading the cloud organization, anyone in Justin's organization should have access to the console. right? But you know, if there's four levers of management between you and that person, it's hard to pick up that influence without having to do a lot of API lookups. So, well, I have a cloud journey for you, and this one was brought to us by Google this week. So basically, creating and implementing reliable systems of code and infrastructure forms the disciplines of systems engineering, which is used by, of course, by Google SRE. And so they've compiled a list of great resources to help you learn more about systems engineering and the best practices and resources for you. And I thought they had some really good ones here in their course. So first of all, is a Usenix course called System Engineering Side of Site Reliability Engineering. It's a Usenix paper and basically talks about what is a system engineer and how it might be different from a given SRE or a software engineer or a sysadmin. And so it gives you a very clear definition of what that is. They give you a non-abstract large system design course from the SRE workbook, which gives you ability to design systems reliably and scalably, requiring a focused, practical approach, which we call non-abstract large system design. And that'll give you ability to iterate and do a bunch of things. They have a distributed image server workshop in the SRE classroom, which is a self-guided workshop to help you code and deploy a large-scale system using some of those principles you just learned at the non-abstract large system design. They have a Google production environment YouTube talk where they talk for about 15 minutes about all things production of Google, which is just cool geek out anyways. You learn about their physical networking, the Borg cluster management system, persistent file systems, and massive mono repo, and much, much more. Borg cluster manager is the predecessor to Kubernetes, which they still run internally. They have reliable data processing with minimal toil research paper, which talks about ensuring reliability in data processing and how to do it, because it can be tricky, especially with batch jobs and automation. Then they have a how to design a distributed system in 3 hours YouTube talk, which is awesome. Like, please don't put that in production, but I appreciate that you're trying in 3 hours. Implementing the services level objectives, which is an O'Reilly book, which I have in my nightstand by my bed because I've been checking that one out. Making Push on Green a Reality, a research paper all about how to release early and release often. And then the Canary Analysis Services research paper, all about how to do canary safe deployments, which is great. So these are all really good courses, all available to you in the SRE classroom. And I definitely think you could learn quite a bit if you're trying to learn more about systems engineering from this set of resources.
No, this is absolutely a fantastic list of resources, a few of which I'm going to go read versus probably going to sleep at a reasonable hour tonight. And kind of read over and kind of see what they have to say. I think the 3-hour YouTube video, even at 2x, might be beyond my capacity to sit down and watch. But you know, most of the other ones really are interesting. I kind of want to read the SLO book. It's kind of the other one that I think I actually will probably go pick up.
It's pretty good. I've been reading it for about 4 months now because it's not that important to me at the moment. But I bought it and I've read through at least about half of it, and I've learned lots about thinking about SLOs, which is really helpful.
Yeah, with SLOs specifically, like the error budgets and how you charge back and how you kind of handle all that.
How you accrue, how you diminish. Yeah, it's all really helpful.
Yeah, it's always an interesting concept. I've never been anywhere that's actually implemented it in that type of way. Always either, you know, it's the product is like, well, we're still releasing it, so, you know,
yeah,
fix it and keep going. Or the other side is, oh, we release once a year and that's its own level of problems. So
yeah, you have to have teeth in your SLO model. If you're going to do SLOs, you really have to drive the right outcomes. And if your engineering product leadership team says, well, it doesn't matter, we're at zero error budget, we're still shipping, that does not help you. So you had to have a culture that supports SLOs and SLIs.
Yeah.
So the how to design a distributed system in 3 hours is only a 1-hour course. So, you know.
Okay. So 2x I can watch as I walk the dog. So we're good.
Yeah, there you go. But yeah, I'm definitely check that one out too as well. But very good set of resources. I will check out some of them as well that I haven't already read, like the Making Push on Green Reality research paper. I'm sort of intrigued by just because that's something I'm working on at the day job right now. So it's good. Well, that's all I have for you, Matt. I know it was a little short show, but FinOpsX is happening. Like I said, I'm sure I'll have lots of stuff to report next week back on the show. So check that out. And we'll see you next time here in the cloud.
Bye, everyone.
And that is the Week in Cloud. Check out our website, the home of the Cloud Pod, where you can join our newsletter, Slack team, send feedback, or ask questions at thecloudpod.net, or tweet us with the hashtag #poundthecloudpod.